بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Etiquettes of Salat, Part 7, First Discourse, Chapter 6. Concerning or explaining the role of having verve and joy in relation to Salat. Another of the Salat's etiquettes of the heart and other ibadat's etiquettes of the heart, which is important and leads to positive results, namely the disclosure of many dimensions, because the eye is multidimensional, there are many inner dimensions within us, but one of the positive results is it leads to the disclosure of many dimensions and the witnessing of some secrets underlying the ibadat. Is what is this etiquette, which leads to many of our inner dimensions being disclosed before us, which leads to many secrets underlying the ibadat becoming witnessed by us. What is this etiquette? The traveler, this etiquette is that the traveler, with all seriousness, with all gravity, commits and accomplishes one salat or one's ibadat out of verve and joy, plus with an unoccupied mind. Therefore, Imam says, one must not execute these actions, these ibadat, under any circumstances in a state of spiritual fatigue or in a state where the soul is retired and retarded in nature. And these terms will be explained, inshallah, during this session. Hence, one must choose to pray at a time where the soul is forthcoming, rather than the soul being retiring in nature. What does forthcoming mean? It means the soul, the eye, is fresh, full of energy and joy to commit the salat, having no fatigue whatsoever. A feeling like when you're about to see, for example, the president of the country, or the first day at school, or when you're just about to, for example, give a talk, or anything. The examples I'm not very good at, you can think of your own examples, but that spark which becomes enlightened within you before this event, whatever it is, there must be this spark. The same applies for Salat. One must pray in such a state, out of verve, out of joy. There's an inner excitement within you, rather than you being in a state of spiritual fatigue or lethargy, and then doing things as if they're imposed upon you. Then Imam continues, what will happen if one pushes oneself to pray in such a state of fatigue and lassitude? The answer, it may, Imam says, make man become abhorrent towards one's ibadat. Now, here, slowly, we're beginning, Imam is trying to explain the importance, the significance of doing the salat, doing one's ibadat out of verve, out of joy, not out of fatigue. Because if you do it out of fatigue, it's going to lead to adverse effects. One of those adverse effects, the potential is there, that it may make one become abhorrent towards one's ibadat. If you keep doing it as if it's imposed out of tiredness and so on and so forth. Or at least make one indifferent to doing the ibadat. That's another adverse side effect. One may become or acquire this feeling that, you know, of indifference in relation to salat. Then the ibadat can be made to feel burdensome and difficult for one to such an extent that there eventually exists an inner abhorrence of them. One of the consequences of such a negative outcome is that it may divert one from recalling Allah, i.e. thus distancing the spirit from acquiring or attaining to the station of servitude, which is the source of salvation, as in chapter 51, verse 55, I created the jinn and man but to worship me. Worshipping me meaning to know me. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam said, I've never worshipped a Lord I didn't see. See, it's all about seeing.
knowing Allah, having gnosis in relation to Allah. But if you keep on doing the ibadat with spiritual fatigue, with lassitude, out of tiredness, as if it's imposed, you're just distancing yourself from more and more from getting to your objective, attaining to the station of servitude. That's the goal. And attaining to servitude is the source of salvation. It's all about knowing Allah. This knowing involves seeing the realities, the metaphysical realities. But such an irfan, because liya'budun, which in the verse when it says, I created the jinn and the man, but to worship me. Liya'budun, but to worship me. Illa liya'budun. In the traditions it says it means liya'rifun, saved but to know me. But such an irfan, liya'rifun, emanating from the term irfan, this irfan becomes less and less probable when actions are executed in a medium of spiritual fatigue and lethargy. Then Imam continues, such ibadat will not lead to the luminosity of the heart. What does it mean, the luminosity of the heart? It means it will not lead to you recalling Allah constantly. Hence the inner dimension of the eye doesn't become a recipient to true ibadat. It doesn't become molded luminously. Remember that the barzakhi dimension, the fuel of one's barzakh is one's actions. You are your actions. Your actions create your bodies of the hereafter. Not physical or metaphysical, but the actions constitute the fuel to that constitution of our bodies in the hereafter. It's all our actions. Now, if one's actions, such as Salat and other Ibadat, are done in such a way that it's done out of tiredness, spiritual fatigue, not out of joy, what happens is you don't become qualified as a recipient to true Ibadat. What does that mean? It means that the Salat that you're doing, the Ibadat that you're doing, they're not molding the bodies of your hereafter. They're not molding you, because you are your actions. They're not molding you positively. They're not shaping your inner dimensions, which you will face, because this world is a farmyard to the hereafter. It's the hereafter's farmyard. All the actions that you do will be embodied as bodies of the metaphysical realms of existence that follow this physical realm. But if your actions are done out of lethargy, out of spiritual fatigue, they're not done out of verve and joy, you won't be molding your inner dimensions positively. What does that mean? They won't be made second nature within you. They just come and go if it's done out of spiritual lethargy. They don't become properly incorporated within you. Only when actions become properly incorporated within you will those actions be molded positively and be embodied as positive things, which I think we've mentioned traditions on this before in earlier chapters. They'll be embodied as positive things in the metaphysical realms of the hereafter. When they're molded within you, they're a dimension of you now, but you don't see it. Some people do. But in the hereafter, these will be embodied and they will be your bodies. You will be in unity with them. You're in unity with them right now if they become properly incorporated with you. Okay, so such ibadat will not lead to the luminosity of the heart. Hence, the inner dimension of the eye doesn't become a true recipient to ibadat. I.e., those ibadat, they're not molded luminously. After all, we are our actions. Actions construct our bodies in the hereafter. But we have to prepare the proper medium so that these actions produce a positive effect. The aim, as discussed in previous chapters, was that the essence of servitude be imprinted upon the heart. We become Salat, we become Sajdah, we become Ruku, so that the best embodiment arises from such actions. In some traditions, the Sajdah is regarded as heaven. Sajdah is heaven. The reality of the Sajdah, prostration, is heaven. Are the flowers and the gardens, and so on and so forth. But Sajdah is a physical reality with a physical appearance that has to be incorporated, has to be done properly, so it becomes incorporated within your inner dimensions of the self. And once it's incorporated, it becomes, let's say, gardens of heaven. And those gardens of heaven exist right now, if the Sajdah becomes properly incorporated within you. But this Sajdah, it's one reality. Its physical manifestation is the physical movements that we do in Sajdah. But if it's done properly, and Sajdah becomes incorporated in your inner dimensions, in your Barzakhi dimension, for example, in your heavenly dimension, if these become properly incorporated in you, that same reality, which in the physical realm was a set of movements, prostrating and so on and so forth, that same reality, once it enters the Barzakhi dimension of you, it becomes heaven, it becomes gardens, flowers and so on and so forth. But it's the same reality. And now that Barzakhi celestial dimension of heaven, those gardens of heaven, if they become converted into the physical realm, if they were to come down onto the physical realm, it will be translated into the Sajdah. It's one reality, the physical movement. The same with anger and fire. Anger in the physical realm is one reality. It's the same reality when it's converted into the celestial dimension or the Barzakhi dimension, the metaphysical dimension, it becomes fire. Now that fire, if it becomes converted into the physical realm, if it was to descend into a manifestation in this physical realm, it would be seen as anger. It's one reality. Depending on the dimension, it manifests differently. Okay, and now we say this, Imam says. And now, so it's an important matter here. One of the secrets of Ibadat, together with its disciplines, is that during the Ibadat, the will of the soul, the will of the eye, permeates and penetrates through the body, making the latter, the body, invincibly be under the auspices and predomination of the soul, preventing it, the body, and the limbs from committing any act of disobedience, rebellion, or egocentrism. So it's being under the complete submission of the inner celestial forces of the heart, those forces that take one to Allah, bring one closer to Allah. Here now one becomes under the submission of these inner celestial forces. Succeeding in this allows one to eliminate one's preoccupation by nafsul ammara, thus being raised to a higher celestial degree in faith in one's dimension of the eye, and one rising from Iman, faith, but let's say level one faith of Iman, from faith to Taslim, to submission. Now submission, many people may submit, and it's very important. Submission is like level two of Iman. Here Imam says that if you succeed in a manner that the will, the irada of the eye permeates to such a degree over the body and limbs, making the body and limbs so invincibly become under the auspices and submission of the eye, leading to you to not commit and not fall short in the realms of disobedience and rebellion and egocentrism. If you succeed in this, you'll be able to rise now, because you'll escape any preoccupation by nafsul amara, because now the eye is so strong with its will that the body is totally under its control. Now, how does one become strong? All this will come in this chapter and later chapters. And then one rises now. So it's still a descriptive account here by Imam. The practical implications aren't given yet. He doesn't explain how to get here for now, but there are some clues he does give. But during the succeeding chapters, he goes into detail. But anyway, then one rises now. From faith, let's say level one faith, to taslim, which is level two of iman. Taslim is important. Submission. Now, whether you're satisfied or not, but you submit. This is one step higher than the ordinary level of iman that people have. And then you rise, Imam continues, from taslim, that submission, to the station of rida, satisfaction. Some people submit purely and wholly, but they're not satisfied yet. They're still weak in some aspects. But some people have rida. They're satisfied with whatever happens. They submit and they're satisfied. This is a higher level. And then from rida to fana. Rida is like level three of iman. And then you go to level four, the final, where it's fana now. You're now totally annihilated in Allah's will. Okay. Let me see if there's anything here which one can add. I'll go over this again because sometimes some of you may have not listened to previous sessions, although I do advise people to go back, and if they haven't listened to the previous sessions, to go back and make sure that they haven't missed anything, because sometimes it's important to have the preliminaries discussed in the previous chapters in mind when we progress through succeeding chapters. But this I that we have, we said it's a multidimensional extended creature from the earthly dimension to metaphysical immaterial dimensions. But it's one I. This one I, if it's occupied by animalistic characteristics, we call this I the nafs. And I know in the Quran, this the nafs has been classified again into nafsul ammara, lawama, and mutma'inna. But that's another classification that has something else in mind. This is another classification of the I. Here, there are many classifications one can see. They're all extracted from the Quran. They're all extracted from the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt. But still, the classifications have certain things in mind that make them classify the eye differently. But when this eye is occupied with the animalistic characteristics, they call the eye nafs. When the eye has eliminated traces of the animal characteristics, allowing one's aql, one's rationality, if you like, one's intellect to function without bias, here faith starts. And here the I is called aql. Now, aql doesn't purely mean rationality. It's associated with the fact of that absence of animalistic characteristics, allowing you now to act more on a par with your intellect. Sometimes, as a result of wholeheartedly recalling Allah, wholeheartedly, not merely academically, one submits before Allah in all matters because of that constant recalling of Allah. There, the eye is called qalb, and it's on a par with taslim here, whereas in the realm of aql, when the eye is called aql, it's still level one of faith, if you like. But when it comes to the qalb, one recalling Allah now, constantly recalling Him, this is the level of taslim, because only then you can fully submit. But still, satisfaction may not arise yet. The next stage, as a result of detachment from the worldly realm, one now becomes satisfied before Allah and before one's actions. And here, one has reached the station of rida. One has broken from all materialistic and this worldly inclinations. One doesn't, you know, one not only submits, but is wholly satisfied in what one does. whatever the result is. This is one level higher. This is now the station of Redha is on a par with this stage where one is now totally detached from the worldly realm, all be living in this worldly realm. That's the station of, if you recall, Ruh, the spirit. These are stages of the I. We call this now the spirit. The I is called the spirit when it's wholly detached from the worldly realm, but whilst living in this realm, not after dying and entering the hereafter. All these are stages of the I when one is persisting in this physical realm. And then there are many other stages too of the I, but it gets more and more complicated. I don't want to go into that now, although we did refer to it in the, I think, the first or second session. But here I just wanted to explain that the level of taslim, submission, is on a par with the dimension of the qalb, heart, whereas the level of redha, being satisfied before Allah, is on a par with the dimension of the ruh, the spirit, that dimension of the eye. And then the next dimension was the dimension of sir, the secret. I mean, you being the sir, you've reached a certain level, and that's usually the level of fana, of being totally annihilated in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And there are two other stages after that too. But one has to note here that a strong will is required, where once all satanic preoccupations become lessened and become non-existent eventually, this strong will plus that verve and joy, these two elements together, which have been mentioned in this chapter, chapter 6, these two are necessary for one to spiritually elevate. And then Imam says it's during such a process of elevation that a glimmer of the secrets to ibadat is perceived by the eye, i.e. the divine manifestations of actions become witnessed by one. One now sees, not with the physical eye, the divine aspect to one's actions. One sees heaven. All this is only possible when the ibadat are executed, Imam says, in a state of joy and ecstasy, and not in a state of spiritual fatigue and weariness and burden. So that love in recalling Allah and the station of servitude is realized for one eventually. This love and this station of servitude, how is it realized? Two things. One is where the will becomes so strong that the body becomes totally under its control, and then one rises above the different stages and degrees of iman. But also, in addition to this, all these actions, they have to be done in that medium of spiritual verve and joy and ecstasy. One has to have that inner joy when one does and executes these ibadat, and only then when one grow, and with this eventual growth of one, i.e. with that strong will and with that verve and joy, eventually a glimmer, Imam says, a glimmer of the secrets to ibadat becomes visible to you, but not visible with the physical eye. So you're doing salat, you're doing other ibadat, and then you begin seeing. You begin having visions. Okay. Recalling Allah is the goal. In the same way that medical doctors state that eating in a state of joy and happiness enhances one's digestion, the spiritual doctors state that executing the ibadat in such a state, i.e. in a state of that joy and happiness, realizes effects upon the heart quicker, allowing oneself to refine oneself more efficiently. If you commit actions, the ibadat, in a state of joy and happiness, rather than fatigue and lethargy, you will allow those actions to become incorporated within you more efficiently and at a quicker rate. And once those become incorporated within you, those actions, they become you. They are now inner dimensions of you. And then, with that strong will and continuing to do the ibadat out of verve and joy, then you begin seeing your inner dimensions whilst awake in the physical realm. They'll manifest gradually before you. But you have to keep on rising those different degrees from Iman to Taslim, Taslim to Ridha, and so on and so forth. Why all this elevation in this elevation up the different degrees of faith makes you more and more, it makes you become more and more detached from the worldly life and more closer to Allah. It's that detachment that allows you to begin seeing. And then the secrets of the ibadat, the secrets of the eye. Why the secrets of the eye? Because these things have all become incorporated within you now. You being that multidimensional creature, you being the possessor of many metaphysical realms of existence. And then you begin seeing it, it becomes manifested before you. But not after death. I mean, most people will see even the good things after death. They weren't able, they didn't have that capacity to see it here. They never entered the realms of Taslim and Ridha and Haya. But they will see it after death. But some people, with that detachment, that level of ruh being attained to, they begin seeing here in this world. فَتَمَثَّلَ لَهَا بَشَرًا سَوِيًّا Chapter 19, verse 17. Okay. Then Imam says that this etiquette has been referred to by verses and traditions, chapter 9, verse 54, and they don't perform the salat but lazily, and they don't give charity but reluctantly. He's saying, no, all these ibadat, they have to be done out of joy, happiness, verve, ecstasy. Otherwise you won't grow. You'll just remain asleep. You'll remain spiritually dormant, spiritually latent. Chapter 4, verse 43, don't approach the salat when you're intoxicated, physically intoxicated. One has to, you know, that inner joy has to be there. If you're not understanding anything that you're saying, there's no point there. In traditions, Imam brings one tradition where Imam Sadiq alayhi salam quotes the Holy Messenger sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam as having said, O Ali alayhi salam, this religion is upright and firm in place. Treat it with compassion and leniency, and don't assign your Lord's worship as abhorrent. No, treat it with compassion and leniency, not aggression, or don't treat religion tightly, because what will be the side effect? It'll lead you to see and view the Lord's worship as hateful. You'll begin acquiring feelings of hate towards it. You have to be careful how you treat your children. These things are important. Don't lay the seeds of hatred in relation to ibadat to your children. How? By forcing them. When you see your child, okay, there's a minimum which is wajib. There, even there, you shouldn't force them. You have to really do your utmost that they do these actions. But anything else, don't push them. Be careful. And then, after many years, there's no wonder why they may become, you know, misguided, and they have no feeling of joy when you go to pray and you see your children not praying. Well, don't be surprised. It's a very delicate theme, this. Imam, as we'll see in the rest of the session, he really does refer to some very sensitive points. And then there's one tradition from Imam Askari alayhi salam, the 11th successor to the Holy Prophet, where he says, whenever the heart is joyful, trust it with things. But when it's reluctant, when it's retiring in nature, let them be. Okay, that's it. Just let them be. It's not the time for you to do salat when the soul is retiring. Just let them be. Wait for a better and appropriate, a better time. Now, from these and other traditions, Imam says that now an important etiquette arises. Now he wants to, within this chapter of which explains the concept of verve and joy in relation to the ibadat,
within this chapter, not a separate chapter, Imam says now an important etiquette arises. When looking at these traditions and the verses, there's a sub etiquette, if you like, which arises, and that is mura'at, observance. Now, what does this entail? He says this entails that the traveler, the salik, at whatever level he or she is at, be it at the level of, you know, doing one's actions academically or doing it wholeheartedly or whatever, they must treat the eye leniently so that they don't impose more than what the eye can actually tolerate. Now, most people fail here. It wouldn't have been deemed an important etiquette if people were doing it properly. But the problem is people aren't lenient to themselves in action, and they're not lenient to themselves in knowledge. In action, because people are overburdening themselves in action. We see it with the people around us and with ourselves, that we're burdening ourselves. We're not observing ourselves in relation to actions. And we keep on doing ibadat over the top. What does that lead to? It leads to you doing the ibadat tastelessly. And then once you do your ibadat tastelessly, you're acquiring shimr-like qualities now. Because shimr, he would do all the ibadat, he would do salatul layl every night. But they were done all tastelessly. Once ibadat are done and executed tastelessly, now the ego starts increasing. Other vicious attributes begin predominating the self. When there's no taste to ibadat, those ibadat, it's polluting you. Okay, there's a minimum which is wajib, even if it's done tastelessly. That's the red line. You can't compromise there. But other than the wajibat, be careful. You have to know how to treat yourself. You have to treat yourself leniently with compassion. Don't impose upon yourself more than that you can tolerate. Now, some people overburden themselves in relation to action, and other people, they overburden themselves and they don't treat themselves leniently in relation to knowledge. Here, people can overdo it too. They keep on pushing themselves to the limit in relation to matters of knowledge, thinking that they can understand, and they keep on reading a lot of materials without having studied and understood the proper preliminaries to those materials. They want to jump from step one to jump to step seven, and they want to read and acquire knowledge in relation to step seven without having studied step 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Unfortunately, because of the lack of scholars in the West, we're seeing that many common lay people now are overburdening themselves in this regard without them knowing it. And most of them have this pseudo-impression that they even know what they're reading in step 7 without even having studied the preliminaries. These people too, they're overburdening themselves. And this will lead to difficulties and side effects, one of them being it increases their arrogance. Then they begin criticizing other scholars even. This arrogance becomes predominated when you overburden yourself with knowledge. Knowledge that you can't tolerate, you can't digest yet. So one shouldn't overburden oneself. It's all about observance here. You have to treat the eye leniently. You may not be able to tolerate things. Don't do them. Be it in the realm of action or in the domain of knowledge. It's like the child, for example, who keeps eating chocolate at Alton Towers, that amusement park in England, and they keep on eating chocolate. Then, now they want to go on the roller coaster after eating a lot of chocolate. Then they go on the roller coaster, and then it ends up in them, forgive the expression, vomiting or throwing up, sorry. Why? When they had the chocolate, then they had to have a rest. Not immediately go on the roller coaster. But they overburdened themselves. They didn't treat the eye leniently. This was just, you know, a physical example I gave here. Then Imam adds that this threat applies particularly to the youth who, if they don't treat themselves leniently, at a slow but sure pace, they may become afflicted with a great danger whose reversibility may no longer be feasible, and one can no longer compensate. And that danger is, look how important this etiquette of observance of mura'at is, that the youth be careful. The youth, be careful, because you may pass a threshold, that after you pass this threshold, there's no going back. What is that danger? Imam says, and that danger is as follows. Sometimes the soul, as a result of extraordinary hardships that it undergoes, for example, fasting every day, or refraining excessively from certain joys, okay? As a result of these extraordinary hardships that it undergoes, and as a result of pulling the reins of, let's say, like the horse, when the rider pulls the reins of the horse, so controlling the horse, for example. So let me start again, because Imam sometimes, he uses a lot of figurative language in the middle of these sentences. It becomes difficult to translate. So that danger is that sometimes the soul, as a result of extraordinary hardships that it undergoes, and as a result of pulling the reins excessively, the reins get torn, and the soul loses control of the reins, i.e. one's control of the soul is lost. And then one's nature tends towards the opposite effect in excess. Once the reins of control are lost, because of those extraordinary hardships that you've burdened yourself with, now one's nature acts in the opposite way. You kept on fasting every day, you overdid it, the reins got torn, now the nature wants to eat every day now, and it overdoes it, leading to one's destruction, both spiritually and maybe even physically. God forbid, if the traveler's reins get torn, or the ascetic becomes willness, loses one's will, here meaning either not having an ustad or not having a proper education, and thus leaving everything behind, such a person will fall into an abyss, never seeing the light of salvation and never returning to the path of prosperity and salvation. Now this potential is always there, but if it happens, it's very difficult to return, almost impossible. The reins should never get torn, because it'll lead to a stage where you'll leave everything now. The salat, you did salat too much, the mustahabbat, you overdid it, then you forget everything, you put it all behind. It's interesting that Imam says that even if the ascetic becomes willness, the ascetic can lose the reins of control too. The zahid, you see the urafa in their works, they attack the zahid. The zahid, the ascetic, means someone who acts as if they're religious in society, but they're not truly religious. They have their beard and they do all the wajibat, but the inner dimensions, the true self, their irfan, is almost zero. It's all a show. But even the ascetic, they may overdo things. God forbid if when they overdo things, the reins get torn, because there's no irfan associated with their actions. They're not doing those esoteric etiquettes properly. It's all a show. And Imam, in many of his poems, he attacks the ascetics, the zahid people. Okay. Hence, like an astute physician, the traveller, the salik to Allah, must read one's pulse during one's wayfaring, and must treat one's soul in accordance with one's state's conditions during these days of wayfaring. You have to check your pulse, spiritually speaking. As you grow, see what your states are and act on a par with those states of yours. For everyone it's different. That's why it's important to, it's good to have an ustad, it's important. And so, when occupied with sexual instincts, one must not inhibit one's nature's biological call and natural pull of nature. When when the body is in want of the spiritual, the sexual instinct, Imam is giving this example now of how things can be overdone. When you need this sexual instinct to be released and for it to be functioned, here, instead of, you shouldn't inhibit this call of nature, this natural pull of nature, nature's biological call here. You shouldn't inhibit it. Rather, Imam says, one must extinguish the fire of passion, that sexual instinct, by means of the tools and ways laid out by the Sharia. Doing so will act as an aid for one's wayfaring to Allah, to truth. So in this example with the sexual instinct, hence one should marry, as this is a major divine custom. And in addition to preserving humankind, it plays an essential role vis-a-vis one's hereafter. Marriage is important for one's hereafter. In the series of Women in Islam from an Irfani angle, there we went through many traditions. There are two things which give tranquility and composure to the heart. Tranquility, itmi'nan, and composure, that's sakina. Two things in the Quran are mentioned giving this tranquility. One is dhikrullah, recalling Allah in different ways, and one is marriage. Marriage has been assigned to provide that sakina, that composure of the heart. So marriage is a holy thing. So in addition to its physical benefits, and in addition to you satiating the sexual instinct, there are many spiritual benefits associated with marriage. Whoever marries has affirmed half of one's religion. Why? All these have been discussed. I don't want to go through all these here. I mean, Imam, he just mentions the traditions here. But for those who are interested, they have to go in Women in Islam. There, Ibn Arabi, the way he explains these traditions, it's incredible. The way the Holy Prophet describes women, describes marriage. The Urafa have gone into the esoteric dimensions of marriage. They've explained these traditions in the best way. And that's why we have all these traditions on marriage. Marriage is important. Other traditions, most of the inmates of hell are those who are never married. See, these are very delicate, these have delicate meanings. And there are many other traditions. I won't now go through all of them, but it's worth reading them and going through those series too. Then Imam says, in general, for the wayfarer to the hereafter, observing the soul's forthcoming state, and the state which is very spiritually motivating, and observing the soul's retiring states, where the soul is now very spiritually weary, spiritual fatigue. Observing these states are necessary. In the same way, one shouldn't inhibit one's passions, because if you do, it'll be a cause to you, leading you to vice and vicious actions. In the same way you should inhibit one's passions, one should also not pressurize oneself too much with burden and difficulty pertaining to actions and ibadat during your suluk. Observe them carefully. Observance, mura'at, be careful. Neither inhibit yourself from certain things, neither overdo certain things. This is especially, Imam says, the case with the youth, and those who are beginners in wayfaring, don't push them. It'll lead to their abhorrence in relation to these actions. Be very careful. Then Imam says there are traditions which back what we've said so far in relation to this aspect of mura'at and observance. We have traditions here. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in one tradition says, during my youth, I would execute a lot of a'mal with a lot of gravity and endeavor. My father then said to me, O my son, do less than this. Because when Allah loves a servant, you see, here you have to make sure Allah loves you. It's not about quantitative actions. Quality is important. So Imam Baqir alayhi salam, the father of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, son, do less than this, because when Allah loves a servant, Allah will be pleased with less. That's the tradition. So when Allah loves someone, you then become mukhlas in his presence, always recalling him. And there's no need to overdo things anymore. You're always in his presence. It's not about quantity, it's about quality. You just make sure you become a mukhlas. And that we, maybe none of us will become a mukhlas. It doesn't matter, but that's the aim. That's what liya'rifun means. That's what liya'budun means. Becoming mukhlas. Not only mukhlas. Not only dedicating one's actions for Allah, you're dedicating the eye for Allah. Okay. In another tradition, the Holy Messenger sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam says, verily this religion is firmly established. It's upright and firm. Treat it with compassion and leniency, meaning not aggression, or don't treat it tightly. And don't assign over yourself your Lord's worship. Don't assign your Lord's worship as abhorrent, because that's what will happen if you treat your religion with aggression rather than with compassion and leniency. And if you do treat it with compassion, the Imam, the Holy Messenger continues, then you'll be like a rider that goes over the top, the rider of a horse, when they treat the horse over the top with aggression, neither reaching one's destination nor allowing the horse to remain healthy, because they keep on holding on to the reins so hard they'll never get to their destination. If we treat our religion too hard, if we overdo it, we'll never reach our destination, our objective in spirituality. And also, you'll harm the horse if you keep on holding on to the reins too hard, meaning you will harm your body and spirit if you overdo things. In another tradition, the Holy Messenger says, don't make Allah's servitude be deemed abhorrent to yourself. And then other traditions too. Okay. The criterion now. Imam is now ending this whole section. He's saying the criterion with respect to mura'at, with respect to observance, is that one be aware. This is the key word. You have to be aware of one's self's states. Be aware of your states. And to wayfare, to progress spiritually, in proportion to the weaknesses and strengths of yourself. So first be aware of your states, and then observance means by you wayfaring in proportion to that understanding and awareness that you had in relation to yourself. But if you're not aware of your strengths and weaknesses, and you just keep on overdoing it in action or knowledge, no, you're going to die soon spiritually. Now, the stronger and the more tolerant one is, the more serious and endeavoring one can be in relation to one's ibadat. Yeah, there's no problem there. As long as you are tolerant, as long as you are strong. Then Imam says something very important for those like me. And yes, for those like me, he says, now he's coming out of from the youth now. He's saying, before he was speaking about the youth, he's saying, those who are of middle age and who have passed the era of youth, and so the fire of their animalistic dimensions has died down somewhat, because in the youth, one's sexual dimension and other dimensions of the animal self were strong. But from middle age, from let's say 40 onwards, if that is middle age, I'm not sure, there, now those animalistic characteristics, they die down. They don't become non-existent, but they do die down somewhat. Imam says, for these people of middle age who have passed the era of youth, and so the fire of these animalistic dimensions has died down somewhat, it's expected from these people that they dedicate themselves more in the domains of suluk and disciplining the self. It's expected now. Because now there's no excuse. Then Imam says, the more one accustoms the soul with discipline, one will observe other doors opening up before one, and then eventually, bit by bit, one's soul will predominate over the body's faculties, and the latter being totally under the auspices of the soul's invincibility. And to end, Imam delicately hands us some keys and criteria by saying that some traditions speak of the virtue of seriously disciplining one's own soul and seriously endeavouring with acts of worship. And it speaks of how the Imams would carry out things like that. And then Imam says we have other traditions though that speak of moderation and leniency in relation to the ibadat. Now the question is, how are these two sets of traditions compatible with one another? Then Imam says the answer is, it's due these the different tones of these two sets. Why do we have them? How can we make them compatible with one another? Or are they just incompatible? And Imam says, no, they are compatible with one another. But how? It's due to the differences between Ahlul Suluk, between the people who are wayfaring. There are differences of states between them. You can't look at them all equally. The tariqas are different. One tariqah is based on love, others are based on other things. The strengths and weaknesses are different. There are differences of the levels of the soul. One is mukhlas, one isn't. One is level 1 of faith, one is level 2 of faith. There are differences of the states of the soul. One is nafsul lawame, one is nafsul mutma'inna, for example. But the general and universal criterion, though, is that the soul's joy and strength and forthcoming nature, once that exists, okay, versus the soul's fatigue and retiring nature. If the soul is very forthcoming, very joyful, very strong, yes, do the ibadat. They can't stop you doing the ibadat. But if you see someone doing the ibadat, you think, then you say to them, why is he doing a lot of ibadat? Well, you haven't reached that stage. They are very forthcoming. They have a lot of spiritual verve and joy. They can do it. They can't not do it. But then some people, their soul is very spiritually tired. They're very retiring in nature. These people have to observe their ibadat. They have to be more lenient to themselves. And that's why we see the different tone in different traditions in relation to executing the ibadat. وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله وصحبه.